This is John Shannon with Radio Free Galisteo, and today I am speaking with Alan Osborne, who is a co-founder of Southwest Seminars, which is located in Santa Fe. It's an educational nonprofit that specializes in developing programs in Southwest studies. We had him on last month, and he told us about the series of lectures that were happening in the month of March. Today, we're going to talk about what's coming up in April and maybe do a quick recap of the end of this month. Alan, welcome.
John, I'm amazed at what you can accomplish in your other life, which is taking care of the world. Your world includes dogs, cats, Denise, and probably plumbing and everything else. I just said, wow, you're a role model.
That's very kind. That's very kind of you.
It's also true.
Well, you know, we all do what we got to do, right?
So there you go. That's a good motto.
Yes. And anything worth doing is worth doing well, too. That's another good one. And that's something that you guys at Southwest Seminars have been doing for decades now. What's happening over there?
Well, we're not at 30 years, but we're getting amazingly close. And we opened our door to the world in 1997-98. So here we are in 2023. So it's just amazing how time flies. But I am so excited because we have been on a run since we started doing weekly public lectures in the fall of 2021, took a brief respite as a result of Omicron raising its ugly head for a couple of months. In the winter of 2022, we started up again after November, December 21. We started up again in March 22 and been running every single Monday night since. So we've got under our belt, I think, around 40 March to the present March, which is a year. Well, that'd be a 50. That we've done 50 lectures as of the end of this month. And the end of this month, we have the dear, sweet, talented, brilliant curator, singer, dancer, deputy state historian for the state of New Mexico, working in the New Mexico Records and Archives Division, the Department of Cultural Affairs. And her name is Nicolasa Chavez. She is just an angel from heaven. And you want to have Nicolasa on your show because she's just she's a flamenco singer, dancer, scholar. And she's going to do a program because this coming Monday, the 27th of March, is the week before Easter, Holy Week.
Right.
We entered spring at 3:42 p.m. day before yesterday, whether we knew it or not, and it snowed here, so that's a great spring. And she's doing a program called Semana Santa, Holy Week Rituals and Ceremonies. And while you might think that is unicultural, she's a mestiza, she's a Coyota, and when she was growing up in a very well-known bicultural family, Anglo on one side, going back into Scotland and France and all kinds of wonderful places, but Hispanic on the other side, many, many generations of Hispanic Chavez families, including her father, Tom Chavez, who was our dear Palace of the Governors director for a good decade and a half, went on to run the Hispanic Cultural Center, went on to work at the Spanish Colonial Art Museum. Nicolasa became, in addition to being a singer, dancer, flamenco, she became aware of her multicultural heritage, and she really liked that term Coyota, mixed blood, mixed race. In the Spanish colonial world, mixed race people were in the middle. They weren't at the top, but they weren't in the bottom because they weren't of color completely. So the bottom class in Spanish colonial society from the 16th century to the 20th century, really, even though Spain lost control in the 19th century, that's still a Spanish world, right? Hispanic world. She thought Coyote was really cool. And then somebody approached her and told her, oh, I'm so sorry that you're mixed race. She said, oh, yeah, my mom has got this and that and Scottish and French and German, blah, blah. And my dad's Hispanic, going back to 20 or something. Oh, I'm so sorry that you didn't get it all, you know, that you're not, you know, Espanol. Or at least Creole. So the upper classes, John, in the colonial world, in Spain's empire, part of the Holy Roman Empire in the beginning, was a worldwide empire. The upper classes were Spanish-born in Iberia, Españoles, and lower upper class Spanish people of pure blood born in the New World. And the New World, or out of the Old World born, they could be born in the Philippines, they were Creole, Criollo, C-R-I-O-L-L-O. And she was not Espanol or Criollo because she was not limpiez de sangre, pure blood. She was a mixture of outside race, right? In this case, what we say today, Anglo, although Anglo is like pretty big basket. And she thought, well, that's weird. Why is this person being kind of snooty towards me? And so she did a whole lecture for us just a couple of months ago on what it's like to be mixed race. And in her professional career, she has written a New Mexico Book Award book on masters of folk art and the heritage masters of the National Endowment of the Arts that won a New Mexico Book Award. She became a curator at the Spanish Colonial Art Museum. She became a curator of Latin American collections at the Folk Art Museum. And now she's deputy state historian of New Mexico. And she was asked to write an essay. This is what got me onto this particular topic, but recognizing her aha moment as a mixed race woman and her pride. She wanted our audience to know, yes, I've got plenty of Hispanic blood and you can't take me down for that, but I've got all this other stuff that goes all over the world and it could give me a break. So that was really informative. And she tackled it in a most beautiful and respectful and full of pride and respect. But she wrote an essay in a book that's published by Museum of New Mexico. It's called Seasons of Ceremonies. I hadn't been aware of it, but the museum press person, Lisa Neal, very kindly brought us a copy of it. And in that really fantastically photographed book, Seasons of Ceremonies, multicultural ceremonies throughout the year in different cultures in the American Southwest, or as we say, the Mexican North, she wrote an essay on the importance of multicultural recognition of the seasons. So spring means something to Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox Catholic, Jewish, Anglican, non-denominational, Celtic, Gaelic, you name it, indigenous people all over the world, Pueblo people, Navajo, Athabasca and Apache. She talks about this interweaving, this weaving together of all these cultures in season. And her essay is beautiful. So she's going to talk about Holy Week rituals and ceremonies in this part of the world. And it'll be, I think, another eye-opening experience from a woman who can tell it like it is.
And that is on Monday, next Monday,
March 27th, 6 p.m. Hotel Santa Fe. No reservation necessary, although if you let us know you're coming, we'll make sure that you get in the door, pay at the door. It's $20 a person. We give a discount for subscribers. So if they want to come for April and subscribe, we give them a little discount. But that's our March 27th program.
And that's coming right up. Then we're in April on the 3rd. Who do you have?
Well, you just won't believe this. We've known this guy for going on 50 years, but he's from Phoenix, John Allen Ware. Connie thought his middle name was Arthur, and I said, is your middle name Arthur? He said, no, it's Allen. All right. Your mom had something going for her.
Good
she
name.
Named her after, she named you after me. No. So John A. Ware is the founding director of the Indian Arts Museum for the state of New Mexico. Back in the 70s when the MIAC, M-I-A-C, got started, and the collections of SAR, the vault of SAR, and the Laboratory of Anthropology, which was part of the museum system, divided up a really incredible collection of past things retrieved by excavations and in advance, like at the OAS and Eric Lindman, of construction projects. And that collection was divided, and the MIAC, the Museum of Indian Art and Culture, was created to hold what the Laboratory of Anthropology took. SAR kept its part, And the MIAC has been up and running ever since. It's just an incredible institution. John Ware was founding director. Since then, as an archaeologist, he had begun working in the Grand Canyon on primary archaeology and ancestral indigenous archaeology in the Grand Canyon in the 60s. He worked on the Black Mesa Project, which was between Hopi and Navajo, probably in the 70s and the 80s. And he's done programs for us over the years, but for almost 15 years, he disappeared back into Arizona, way down by the Mexican border, as the executive director of the Amerind, American Indian Foundation, which is a very prestigious nonprofit founded in the 30s, I think, based on work that was being done in northern Mexico, which oftentimes we don't talk about because there's a border there now. But as the people there said, well, we never put a border there. You did. So when we come across it, we're coming home, right? Whether they're indigenous or Hispanic or somewhere in between. But John Ware is a is known as having returned to Santa Fe in alleged retirement, but we haven't let him retire too much. We use him for field trips, day trips. We use archaeological day trips. We use him for extended trips. He's going to take us to Bears Ears, along with a former governor of Cochiti in the summer or in the fall. And John Ware is going to talk about his specialty and has now been put into a book. That's what he's known for now, is he worked for a long time on a book, and the book was Social Organization of the Eastern Pueblos. The Eastern Pueblos, when they say Eastern Pueblos, you think, well, there must be a Western Pueblo. So there's an Eastern, there's got to be a Western. Then the answer is, yeah. Everybody knows the Western Pueblos would be Acoma, going on Zia, but going on further west, Zuni, and into Hopi country, right? And they're linguistically different, but they're Western. They're west of the Rio Grande. So John Ware's really claim to academic fame and archaeological research, he's done a lot of work in Navajo country. And the Grand Canyon is multicultural, right? A lot of different groups hold the Grand Canyon area sacred. But in the eastern part of that world of the Pueblos, along the Rio Grande, you have Cochiti, you have Santo Domingo, San Felipe, Santa Ana. And then when you get down toward the Albuquerque Valley, you got to make a right-hand turn as you go south and head west, and Laguna,
right,
Pueblo and Zia are Caries speaking people, Carizan. And the Spaniards spelled that word Q-U-E-R-E-S. Today they usually spell it with a K, K-E-R-E-S, take out the U. And the Carizan or the Caries people on the Rio Grande are different in many scholars' minds than those to the west of the river. So he has written a book called A Pueblo Social History, which has now been used in lots of college classrooms because it really focuses on the Rio Grande Caries people. And when you get down to Albuquerque, Isleta, Sandia, or Tiwa, related to Taos and Picaris up north, they're not Caries. So the Caries corridor along the river is a very special area. Eric Blinman knows a lot about this and has done talks on this as well. He and John have worked very closely together for many decades. But John's going to talk about Chaco Canyon, that's in the west, from downstream, meaning he's going to be looking at what he thinks Chaco was from a Caries point of view. I think that's what he's going to talk about. And we're going to find out on April 3rd at 6 p.m. at Hotel Santa Fe. It's called Chaco, A View from Downstream.
That sounds really exciting. And, you know, of course, being where we're located, all those Eastern Pueblos are just right here. We're bumping up against them.
They're in our backyard. And the good news is they've reopened.
Yeah.
And so I think, as I understand it, and you can call each tribal a government office or the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center and find out for sure. But most of these feast days that are coming up, May 1st happens to be, by the way, May 1st is San Felipe feast day. Yeah. Santo Domingo is in early August, August 4th. Anyway, yeah, this is going to be very exciting. John Ware is very sensitive. He has a lot of Native relationships. He's very well respected. He's very careful what he says, how he says it. And it's going to be an eye opener because a lot of us are confused by, we thought pueblos were all the same.
Right. I think people in their desire to simplify things, lump everything together, and it's just not so. Okay. So that takes care of the first Monday in April. What's coming up on the 10th of April, the second one?
We were contacted last year by Doug Crispin, C-R-I-S-P-I-N. I thought at first he's Crispin. I went, oh, you must be Santo Domingo. Crispin is a, you know, so you get to know what the family names are that kind of give you a hint as where they're coming from. Doesn't mean that's where they live, because if they marry out, marry a woman over here, then they're over here. Or, you know, and he goes, no, I'm not Crispin. I'm Crispin, like crispy toast. Oh, well, what's your claim to fame? He said, I've been wearing a park uniform for 50 years as of when he contacted us. It was 2022. And he said, I come every winter to Albuquerque and hang out until summertime. And in summertime, I go back and put on my park uniform. And get this, as of 2022, he spent 25 years as a park ranger for the state of Oregon in three basic regions of Oregon, which is vastly different, right, from one side to the other, or the Oregon coast of the Pacific, Central Oregon, and the Willamette Valley. And he started as an entry-level park ranger 50 years ago, and he worked his way up to becoming a state of Oregon park manager at three different state parks. And then he started working for the National Park Service for Uncle Sam, Freudian slip. And he was a seasonal ranger, you know, and there's a lot of people you and I know that in college or whatever, after college, they got jobs, seasonal rangers at this park, that park. And he worked his way up from seasonal ranger to all kinds of things. But he's been at 14 different, in his 25 years with the National Park Service, he's been at 14 different national parks.
Wow.
So he wants to come and talk about what he experienced at the North Rim of the Grand Canyon as an interpretive ranger, what he experienced at Mesa Verde as an interpretive ranger, what he experienced as the naturalist at Old Faithful Geyser in Yellowstone, which, by the way, is the birthplace of the Comanche culture, as we understand it from our Oklahoma Comanche friends who know where they came from below up to the surface, and they hold that extraordinarily sacred. There's a brand new book written by a University of Montana scholar that he and I have talked about named, I think, McDonald, who talked about Native American connections to Yellowstone, but he was the naturalist at Old Faithful Geyser. He worked as a naturalist at Grand Teton National Park in Coulter Bay. He was at Rainbow Bridge National Monument, which we've always wanted to go to on the side of Lake Powell, which we've never been to because now you got to hike there. And he was a backcountry interpreter at Rainbow Bridge, which is on Navajo land. And he has graduated from the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. So he's a law enforcement officer in the parks. That's a whole nother discussion topic, right? Why do we need gun-toting park rangers? And the answer is because it can be life-threatening working in a national park for lots of different reasons. And is an EMT medical tech. So Doug Crispin, talking about challenges that he sees. And the good news, I think, is, well, it could be good or it depends. He's not coming as an official spokesperson for either Oregon State Parks, where he did his first half, a quarter century, or the National Parks, where he did his second quarter century. He's coming as a civilian, and that frees him up to say what he feels in his heart and what he's learned in his mind. And I like that because Southwest Seminars never has taken sides, whether we're talking history or culture or this or that. I mean, Rena Swensel at Santa Clara one time said, oh, my grandmother told me that if we plant enough crops in the spring for the Navajo, then they don't have to come and take it. We give it to them. We invite them in and we give it to them. And it's a gift. And I just thought that was very sweet. Yeah, you want a Raider rating, or do you want a Raider sitting down and having a meal and saying thank you? So Doug said that he was going to look forward to providing a little editorializing. And I think that's helpful for somebody that spent 50 years in state and federal parks.
Yeah, he's obviously seen a lot in both venues, I guess, under both employers.
So we're looking forward to that. And he's only available, this was actually April 10th, 6 p.m. at Hotel Santa Fe. No reservations necessary. It's always nice to know if somebody knows they're coming and they can give us their name and we'll put it down and make sure they get in. But Doug is going to be going back to the parks the week following our talk. This was literally the last week he could make this talk. So we feel very fortunate.
Well, it's good you caught him. And it was good that he made himself known to you. That is the 10th. Now the 17th, the third week. What have we got?
This is Radio Free Galisteo. Great conversations from the Galisteo Basin. Radio Free Galisteo is listener supported. Go to www.radiofreegalisteo.com and click on the red donate button in the upper right hand corner to become an active supporting member of Radio Free Galisteo.
Well, for a similar length of time, Dr. Russell Greaves, known as Rusty, who actually lives in Santa Fe within walking distance of the Hotel Santa Fe. But he is a professor at UNM in Albuquerque. And I thought, oh, yeah, that makes sense. So probably a lot of people take the rail runner down and head back home. Mm-hmm. And what's better than living in Santa Fe? Awesome. Or Galisteo, even more awesome. Greaves has spent 40 years in the field. And I took some liberties by calling this talk on April 17th at 6 o'clock at the Hotel Santa Fe, 40 years in the field, because he is at this moment, as we speak, working with one of two major groups he works with. One is in Venezuela called the Pume. And the Pume people are hunter-gatherers in Venezuela who one of the groups of the Pume live on the river and are affected by riverboat traffic full of tourists bringing tennis shoes, Nike tennis shoes, and T-shirts and handing them out to the, you know, to those on the, you know, the Amazonian rainforest. And the others live in a savanna some miles away. And he has worked with the two groups of Pume in Venezuela for decades and seen the one group affected by people like us going on vacation on a riverboat trip and having negative impact or positive, depends on whether you think wearing tennis shoes is good or going barefoot. I mean, it's your point of view, but that is an issue, right? That's an issue. But the other group in the savannah that are far away from any town or any interaction with tourists are absolutely 99% hunter-gatherer. And if they do anything with the outside world, it's a trade. It's a trade. I would trade you what I gather for maybe something you make or whatever. But he is right now not in Venezuela. He's in the Yucatec, Mayan country of on the Yucatan, because his wife is a University of Utah professor, and she's very well known in her field of anthropology. Rusty is an anthropological archaeologist. He is at UNM. His main job is as director of the contract archaeology department, which would be similar to Eric Blinman at OAS formerly. That's contract archaeology. It's often in advance of backhoes and,
oh, right,
and road graders and highway and transmission line right of ways and that kind of thing. But the UNM OCA, Office of Contract Archaeology, very much like our OAS. And Rusty came in and took over actually from one of Eric's former deputy directors at OAS, and Robert De La Russo, who's now retired. And Rusty came in after decades of experience working in the Southwest with Apache Navajo Pueblo people, in the Great Plains with Plains tribes in the Southern Plains in Texas. But his wife has worked for a long time in the Yucatec Maya country of Yucatan. Rusty has done his field research in Choctaw, Louisiana.
Huh.
Choctaws hiding out in the bayous of Louisiana that are affected by all kinds of things, including non-tribal identity. But he's also worked with his wife in the Yucatan. And he is right now until the end of this month in the Yucatan. And he sent me an email before he left saying, hey, Alan, I'm still thinking about what I want to talk about. He came and talked about the Pume in Venezuela just about 6 weeks ago, and I just thought he was unbelievable. John, he is one of the best presenters we've had in over 1,200 programs. He's just incredible. Wow. He's articulate. He's sensitive. He's not excavating. He's learning. He's living with these people and learning. It's like it's ethno-archaeology.
Yeah, it's more like ethnography, right?
Yeah. So he says, I'll tell you very soon, but I'm going to the Yucatan until the end, with, you know, to work on the Maya project. The Yucatec Maya are in the same situation. They're trying to preserve language. They're living in a very highly studied area, but one that's being subjected to development. The Mexican government is building a highway called the Mayan Trail or something, and they're just going to plow through. I mean, this, I don't know if this has been approved or just a dream, but they're, I think it's approved, and they're just going to plow right through to bring tourists to all these to selected sites. And this is horrifying. This is just horrifying.
Yeah.
So anyway, I said, well, okay, you just tell me when you can. And Connie's, you know, biting her fingernails going, Alan, we got to put out the schedule for April. What are we going to say about Rusty? I said, I don't know. Give me a couple hours before Monday night 2 weeks ago and I'll think of something. So I thought up something, 40 years in the field, because he's been 40 years in the field. He's done field work in archaeology, ethnology, evolutionary anthropology, diverse archaeological sites spanning Paleo-Indian, that's greater than 9,000 years ago, clear back to the beginning, 20,000 whatever, up to 19th century Southwest Great Plains, mostly I think Southern Great Plains, and the Great Basin, Nevada to Western Wyoming and parts of Utah and Arizona. Ethno-archaeological fieldwork, we just said, with the Mexican Yucatec Maya and the Venezuela Pume. He's also worked in New Mexico and Arizona with Pueblo and Navajo Diné communities. He's also, and this is really important, he's involved because he recognizes the protection of landscape, view sheds, and modern sound intrusions on places important to Native Americans.
Mm. That's something I'm sure a lot of people don't think about, but is really, really relevant.
And he has appreciation of indigenous histories, not as thoroughly treated. This is a very clever way of saying it. He wants us to know about the histories of indigenous peoples, not as thoroughly treated as more recent New World migrants. Now, who would he be thinking of in terms of recent New World migrant? Pian? I don't think he's talking about border crossers. I don't think he's talking about Plymouth and Jamestown.
Yeah.
That was very, very sensitive. So anyway, I took all of that off of his OCA biography, and I took the liberty of then summarizing it by saying he's going to talk about 40 years in the field, which gives him plenty of wiggle room.
Indeed it does. And he certainly has a lot to choose from out of those 40 years. So
I didn't want him to come out of the jungle and accuse me of pigeonholing him.
Not with a 40-year possibility of choices. Okay, that's the 17th. The final Monday in April is the 24th. Who do you have winding up in April?
Well, we hit a home run. You know, sometimes you take a swing at the ball and you don't know if it's going to make contact or be a foul. But we work very closely with the nationally recognized archaeological organization called the Archaeological Conservancy, TAC. We're doing summer day trips, four of them with them in their honor on their ancient sites. So this summer we're going to sites that the Archaeological Conservancy has purchased, preserved, and kept available for research, but not for development. And in many cases, they have the Conservancy in Albuquerque, which you can join. They're a nonprofit. They publish a magazine quarterly called American Archaeology. And in their couple of issues ago, they had an article about rising sea levels due to glacial melt on the coasts and in the oceans of the world, but also the freshwater lakes that yield human habitation for a very long time, because now, for whatever reason, they're underwater. Uh-huh. And this article on underwater sites, not limited to just coastal sites, but even freshwater lakes, was written by a lady at the University of Texas, Arlington. She's a professor. Her name is Ashley Lemke, L-E-M-K-E. And this article, actually, I said she wrote it. Actually, Tamara Stewart of the Conservancy, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and field manager for the Conservancy, Tamara Jaeger Stewart, does a lot of articles. She's the author. But she mentioned this fantastic professor, Ashley Lemke, doing all this incredible work. And then the next thing you know, I get a book in the mail from Texas A&M, which has published a book that she wrote as a desk copy called Hunting Architecture, meaning things that hunter-gatherers built to facilitate hunting, no matter what it is, whether it's a base camp or a field camp or a field house or whatever, wiki up, whatever. So the title of the book is Hunting Architecture and Underwater Archaeology. Oh, wow. So she has specifically, and immediately said yes when I just wrote her and said, Ashley, I just saw your article in American Archaeology Magazine published by the Conservancy that we've worked with for 20 years. I see that this book has come from Texas A&M and you wrote it. She's a leading researcher on the archaeology of hunter-gatherers. We spent more of our ancestral generations, John, yours, mine, and everybody else's, Nicolasa Chavez and Rusty Greaves and Ashley's ancestors, were hunter-gatherers long before the agricultural revolution.
Right.
Right? Which was yesterday. So she's an expert on researching the archaeology of hunter-gatherers, and in this case, hunting architecture, what they built and what they left behind, which is now underwater. And she's an expert on submerged ancient sites in the Americas, including the Gulf of Mexico, the Great Lakes, and the Atlantic Ocean. Terrestrial and underwater archaeology and she's worked a lot in Europe. She's worked in Canada. From European lower Paleolithic sites in Europe to 19th century Nunavut sites in the Arctic, and 9,000-year-old caribou hunting sites, wow, currently 100 feet below water. So we have had an underwater archaeologist before years ago named Dan Lenihan. And Dan Lenihan, who is an incredible gentleman now retired from the National Park Service, was the head of the National Park Service underwater scuba unit based on Old Santa Fe Trail in Santa Fe. And they used to make fun of him and say, what are you doing here with the underwater unit? You should be in Pearl Harbor or somewhere. He said, this is just where they chose to put it. And here I am. So I'm so excited. Now, Ashley, here's her title. Archaeology's Research Frontier, Submerged Sites in North American Great Lakes. So she's going to focus on what she's doing in the Great Lakes, looking for sites that are currently submerged 100 feet underwater. Should be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, that's really incredible. The fact that we're able to do that sort of archaeological study now, you know, with the advent of underwater breathing apparatus. And that's the start of it. There's a whole lot of other technology and methodology that's used for that particular type of work.
Well, and think about just the recent visit to the Titanic.
Right.
I mean, like last week, and how deep, I mean, good Lord, 100 feet sounds like a swimming pool. I don't know. The Titanic is a few thousand.
Yeah, it's like 3.5 miles or something. Yeah, it's crazy. Okay, so that finishes up April. You want to give us a sneak peek of May?
Yeah, and Ashley Lemke was April 24th, 6 p.m. Hotel Santa Fe. And I wanted to give you a teaser, even though, God willing, spirits willing, you'll let me come back and talk about the next month after that. I don't want to wear out my welcome.
We sure will. We'll have you on.
We have been pestering a Scottish American gentleman who lives in San Antonio, but who was born as an outlander in the Hebrides Islands, I think the Outer Hebrides, and is a Scottish high clan chief council member, Andrew Morrison, who is coming after much pestering and cajoling. But he's been to a lot of our lectures because he comes to Santa Fe and is very well acquainted with Native issues. He's become a Native advocate for Native American issues nationwide, as well as an advocate for his own indigenous Scottish clans that were in constant conflict with Great Britain over a long period of time and were punished for language, punished for they couldn't wear tartans, they couldn't speak their Gaelic and Celtic language base, they couldn't do ceremonies. He's going to come on a very important Celtic ritual day, which is May 1, the Celtic Feast of Beltane. And he's another one that said, well, what do you want me to do? And I said, Andrew, you tell me what you want me to do, which is not put a title down yet because we haven't published our May schedule.
Right.
But he will, I think, illuminate us as to the similarities between the struggles of indigenous peoples all over the world, particularly Native American struggles in America, and the struggles of the Gaelic Celtic descendants of the Pictish, Angles, Saxon tribes that came onto the islands when the Roman Empire was letting go. And this is centuries before the Vikings show up. And so he is a remarkable gentleman. And by the way, he serves in San Antonio where he lives. He's married to an American, lovely American San Antonio lady, dear bride. And they live in San Antonio, but he is the honorary British consul for the British Empire in San Antonio.
Oh, wow.
That's an honorary position. And I said, but wait, you're Scottish. How come they have you doing that? And he said, well, because I'm a Viscount. Oh, he's a British Viscount. And his Viscount title is Viscount Dunrossill, D-U-N-R-O-S-S-I-L. Viscount Dunrossill, Andrew Morrison, because his dad was the Governor General of Australia.
Wow.
And, or his grandfather. And I think he's the third Viscount Dunrossill, but he's a most glorious gentleman, and he does a lot of appearances on Robert Burns days. If you look him up on YouTube, you can see him delivering a Robert Burns Day speech in his tartan. And he's a preservationist. They're faced with tremendous development in the Scottish Highlands and in the Outlander Islands, the Hebrides, wind farms, development, residential development, commercial development. And they're just destroying. It's like the road, the Maya Trail in Mexico. They don't care what's in the way. They just go right through it. And there are ancient sacred sites all over the British Isles, right? And he speaks the language. He knows the literature. He preserves the customs and the traditions. But he's a major advocate for Native American issues. And he's got very close Native contacts throughout the United States. And he will really inform us, and I think it'll be exciting. That's May 1, 6 p.m., Viscount Dunrossill, Scottish High Clan Chief.
That sounds fascinating. You can count on me being there. I've got a Celtic background, so it's...
Good. Well, where are your tartan? I got a friend in Seattle that's going to bring... He was in Scotland. He made contact with Andrew Morrison. I told him, you got to make contact with Andrew Morrison while you're there. And he did. And he went to visit his own. My friend Jerry Meyer will be in the audience. And I said, and he got his tartan while he was in Scotland. And I said, you better be wearing it. And he said, well, I got to get up in Seattle. I said, I don't care. You get it here and you wear it. And you might be the second.
Well, you know, the only kilt that I have right now is a black watch kilt because I served with them in Afghanistan. And so I believe I looked up at some point that since I served alongside them, I'm able to wear their colors. But the Shannon, the actual Shannon, which is Irish but out of Scotland. Yeah. So
well, you'll make a new friend, and he will fill you in on everything you need to know that you don't know. and you fill him in on what you do. But if you were given that privilege of the Black Watch, it would be an honor, because Jerry Meyer will I'm pretty certain be flourishing. And if you look up YouTube, Andrew Morrison, you'll see his speech for the Robert Burns Day. And he does this all over the country. And it was really a lovely tribute in Gaelic.
Now, are you by any chance going to be having haggis for snacks on that Monday night?
I'm going to put that on Jerry Meyer's plate. I'm afraid to ask for Andrew any special favors. He's already granted me quite a few.
All right.
But okay. I'll say John Shannon requested haggis.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Lord Morrison.
Yeah, I'm a very big fan. Wow. So plenty of stuff coming up. A bunch of exciting, interesting speakers as usual. Thank you for running through all those with us today, Alan.
My privilege. It's an honor, John.
It's good to have you on. And we'll do the same thing next month as we're rounding out this session. Any final thoughts?
Yes. Thank you for your service.
Thanks, Alan. Thank you. I appreciate it. Happy proud to serve.
My dad was a World War II foot soldier, came in after D-Day, and, you know, at that time, and went from France to Belgium to Germany and helped liberate Munich. He didn't talk much about it, but he did go to my sister's boys' grade school and do a talk. Connie's dad was a bomber pilot in three wars, World War II, the Berlin Airlift, Korea and Vietnam, and was a SAC base commander at one time. But I just want to say thank you for what you do now. Thank you for what you did, what you always have done. And it's very clear from the day I met you that you're very special. And that has to do, I'm sure, with Denise, too, because she's part of the story.
She sure is. Denise Lynch, our co-producer and co-owner here at Radio Free Galisteo, who, you know, is going to be very interested in hearing about the origins of the Comanche people with connected to Old Faithful, because that's part of her heritage as well.
Absolutely. Thank you.
My pleasure. Alan, thanks again. And we'll see you next month. And for Radio Free Galisteo, I'm John Shannon.